You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
If you think of the Middle East in this modern time, you can't help but say the word Palestine. People there have lost their land. Some have lost their home. They live in other countries, their freedom almost gone. Palestine needs her freedom. Palestine needs our love. Palestine needs her freedom. Palestine needs our love.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with Lucy Murphy's music, Palestine, to introduce British MP George Galloway on tour in the United States. George Galloway, born in 1954, is a British politician, author, and broadcaster who has been a member of Parliament since 1987 and is known for his outspoken views. He was a Labour Party MP for Glasgow Hillhead and for Glasgow Kelvin before his expulsion from the party in October 2003, and subsequently becoming a founding member of Respect. He currently represents the Bethnal Green and Bow constituency, having been most recently elected to that seat in 2005. Earlier this year, Galloway was banned from Canada for his anti-war views. He was due to give a speech in Canada on March 30th, and a Canadian spokesman confirmed that the Respect MP had been deemed inadmissible on national security grounds and would not be allowed into the country because of his views on Afghanistan and the presence of Canadian troops there. A spokesman for Citizenship and Immigration Canada said the decision had been taken by border security officials, quote, based on a number of factors, unquote, in accordance with Section 34(1) of the country's Immigration Act. Jason Kenney, Canada's immigration minister, has the right to exempt people from the act if it is felt that their presence would not be detrimental to the national interest. They elected not to exempt Galloway, and in fact, he remained banned. This recording that we're about to hear is from Galloway's speech in Berkeley, California, May 20th, just last week. Thanks to Martin Spencer Davies for sharing the recording.
Brothers and sisters, comrades and friends, wassalamu alaikum, peace be on all of you. I'm really honored to be on this platform with my fellow speakers under the banner of Mecca. What a wonderful acronym, and I salute the fantastic work that Mecca has been doing in the Middle East and will do, God willing, in the years to come, and I hope to work increasingly closely with them, especially in relation to the situation in Palestine and in Gaza in particular, which will be the main problem of my remarks this evening. I've been spending a lot of time in the United States, 50 speeches last month, 4 to Canada, that has to be by video, because according to the Canadians, I'm a dangerous terrorist, you know, which will come as a surprise to the British Parliament, to which, as Barbara said, I've been 5 times elected, and in which I sit, and certainly a surprise to the Homeland Security Department in the United States of America. So 15 cities last month, 10 cities this month, and if God spares me, many more cities in the next few weeks in June and July for reasons which I shall come back to later on. And so I should make this disclaimer that although my name is George, I have no intention of recolonizing I'm not here to teach mothers or grandmothers to suck eggs. I'm just doing my best with whatever reputation the internet and YouTube and Press TV and my show on TalkSport has brought me on this side of the Atlantic. It's not that I want to help recreate the British Empire. I know that upon it the sun never set. Though, as my Irish grandfather used to say, that's because God would never trust the British in the dark. And he was absolutely right about that. But of course, no discussion of Palestine could begin with anything other than a recitation of the original sin. Britain is the author of the Palestinian tragedy. Britain is the original sin. In the building in which I have sat for the last 20 years now, Mr. Balfour, the British Foreign Minister, on behalf of one people, promised a second people, who, by the way, represented only a tiny fraction of international Jewry at the time. He promised that second people the land which belonged to a third people. Even by imperial standards, it was a particularly brazen thing to do, to give away land which not only didn't belong to you, but which you didn't even then occupy. And everything that has happened to the Palestinians has flowed from that division. And here I make, I think, an important point, maybe well known to all of you, but as others will hear this on YouTube and on the radio and so on, it's a point worth making. Mr. Balfour did not make that promise to the Zionists, who, by the way, were, to a man, atheists, laying no biblical claim to Palestine at all. For those who now, ex post facto, seek to use God as an estate agent, having promised this land to them, they were ready at that time to make their European colonial settler state in many different places. We discussed the Seychelles, Patagonia, Uganda, and other places. They laid no biblical claim to Palestine. Mr. Balfour did not make this promise to them because he liked Jews. In fact, he hated Jews. He was an anti-Semite. He wanted the Jews to leave England and go to Palestine or anywhere else so that he would not have to look upon their faces again. And this is a critically important point. We reject and refuse the idea that Judaism equals Zionism or that Zionism equals Judaism. We absolutely reject this synonym because it leads in many dark tunnels to many wicked things. Anti-Semitism is racism, pure and simple. Indeed, it is the most virulent strain of racism because it caused the mass murder, the attempted genocide of millions of Jewish people in Europe during the 1930s and 40s. Many Jews are not Zionists. Most Zionists are not Jews. And anybody who thinks George Bush likes Jews has never visited his golf club. The point is that Zionism presented itself to the British Empire, as it does now to the American Empire, as a means of establishing a European colonial settler state, just like the one in South Africa, just like the one in the then Rhodesia, and in many other places. It's a settler state, pure and simple. And that's why it's possible. Indeed, that's why it's vital that those who wish to see justice for the Palestinian people reach out and find allies amongst Jews in America, in Britain, and around the world, including, by the way, in Israel. And don't think it's not possible. There are many Jews in this audience, indeed organizing this meeting. I'm one of the few people on the left who was able to spend significant time in South Africa under apartheid. I was sent there by the African National Congress, undercover, to do important political work. And every house in which I slept, every car in which I traveled, Every dinner I ate and every rand I spent was given to me by Jewish members of the African National Congress. Most of them communists, by the way. Now these people were Jews, but they were with liberation and against apartheid. And we have to win the argument here in this country with Jews that Israel is an apartheid state just like apartheid South Africa was. My mother in our introduction was making the point that it's necessary to demonstrate, that it's necessary to put feet on the streets, people on the streets, to show what it is that we're fighting for. And that's where I want to start the main button of my remarks this evening. Because we were demonstrating on the 10th of January of this year in London, 100,000 of us marching through the streets of London, heading for the Israeli embassy in Kensington, which we did every day, every night, every weekend during the 22-day aggression against the Gaza Strip. And the snow was falling, the night was falling, as I began to think about what I was going to say on the platform at the end of the march. And it struck me that whilst demonstrating was necessary, it was not sufficient. That it was important to protest, but it was not sufficient to protest. That we had to do something practical to come to the relief of the people who were suffering this atrocity in front of our eyes. And we were able to see that atrocity, by the way, in a way which we had not been able to see previous crimes committed against the Palestinian people. You see, we're no longer, as tonight proves, look at all these cameras and microphones, all these radio stations. Forgive me, I don't keep up with the alphabet soup of American radio stations, but I know that they've all got initials, and there are many, many of them employing some of the best people in this land and talking to some of the best people in this land on a daily basis. And as Barbara said, it's crucial to keep those voices going. But we knew what was happening in Gaza, because we're no longer dependent on Rupert Murdoch and Fox News and the Bush and Blair Corporation, which used to belong as the BBC, because we have access now to pictures and to information through the internet, through all these new digital channels. I myself, as I say, present two programs every week on Press TV. You can get them. I think some of you watch them. And because we were able to watch, we were able to see the scale of the brutality which was being visited upon a captive and overwhelmingly civilian population. This is an important point to make when people bandy words around like terror and terrorism. The Palestinians in Gaza have no air force. They have no navy. They have no anti-aircraft weapons. They have only small personal weapons and nothing else. They have homemade rockets that go up in the air and nobody knows where they'll land. Militarily completely ineffectual. The overwhelming point about the 22 days that we witnessed is that it was a practically, to all practical purposes, defenseless population that was being assailed in that brutal way. And thus, in most other conflicts, civilian people can flee, can run away from the bombardment, can hide. But the people doing the bombardment of Gaza had taken the precaution of locking all the doors so that there was nowhere for the people to hide, nowhere for the people to run. And what a bombardment it was. I'd like to spend a moment talking about the use of white phosphorus gas. Imagine a state calling itself, though we don't accept it, the Jewish state, dropping gas on civilian people. Can there be anything more obscene? A country that calls itself the only democracy in the Middle East, and we'll come back to that, dropping gas on civilians that they've locked up in a huge concentration camp. And we saw it happening live on TV. Now, as it happens, I'm a bit of an expert on white phosphorus. I spent the best years of my life from 1977 until the day of his death in Paris at the side of my late comrade, President Yasser Arafat. I was with him in Beirut in 1982 when Israel invaded, not for the first or the last time, and advanced on Beirut and began systematically to reduce the Arab capital city to rubble and ash. And it was there that they used for the first time white phosphorus as a weapon. And I personally visited the hospitals and saw children who were victims of the use of this phosphorus gas. I watched as white smoke came from their noses and their mouths. Because you see, once you breathe this phosphorus, you can never breathe it out until you are dead. Because its purpose, when inhaled, when ingested, is to cook the victim from the inside, to bake the people to death who have ingested it. And I watched them die. That was in 1982, but we didn't see it dropping live on television then. We did see it dropping from the 27th of December last. After 22 days, and we saw it actually dropping on United Nations compounds, United Nations schools and warehouses and other clinics and other United Nations installations. And I ask you this, I ask myself, but I really don't know the answer. How can it be that a country like Israel can continue to be a member of the United Nations when it's killing the United Nations staff and bombing the phosphorus gas? We saw it, we had Al Jazeera and Press TV, that little girl, 3 years old, from the killing field of Zaytuna on the edge of Gaza City, brought to the Shifa Hospital after lying out for 3 days. The ambulance personnel having been told that they would be killed if they went into Zaytuna to try to rescue the dying, to try to recover the bodies of the dead. I vividly recall this little girl, age 3, her face blackened by flames and by the sun, where she lay out for 3 days, minus her arm and her leg, which had been eaten by the dogs that were roaming through the ruins of Zaytuna, eating the dead people who lay there uncollected. I remember very well the report in the Guardian of the little girl that was found dead in Zaytuna, still suffering on the toe of her dead mother. I remember the little girl, age 9, whom I subsequently met and interviewed, standing in the ruins of our house in Gaza, one of 61,200 houses that were destroyed. I don't know how many houses there are in Berkeley, but try to imagine 61,200 houses in Berkeley destroyed in 22 days, and the families whose houses they were living amongst the ruins. I interviewed this little girl in the ruins of that house. Those rubble, those ruins were all that she has left in the world. She had been staying with her grandmother and returned to her house to discover that her mother and her father and all 5 of her brothers had been killed in one bomb landing on their house. That girl asked me some searching questions, which I am now going to address to you. She said, where is this Arab world that they teach us about in school? Where is this Ummah, this Muslim nation that they teach us about in the mosque? Why did they leave us alone? Why did they leave us alone? I turned away when she repeated this question, because I don't know the answer. another college looks in here, I address the Arab and Muslim part of this audience in particular. This crime, this 61-year crime against the Palestinian people would not be possible if it were not for the collaboration of the puppet presidents and the corrupt kings who rule the Arab world almost without exception from one end to the other. That's the truth. And there's another truth that was alluded to by Barbara in her introduction, and that is that none of these crimes could be committed if it were not for the fact that every bullet, every rocket, every F-16, every Apache helicopter gunship, every shell fired from a tank or from a warship is given to Israel absolutely free by the United States taxpayer and by the government of the United States. That's the truth of it. So the blood is on the hands, not just of Israel, not just of Britain, the original imperial sinner, but of the United States of America. And one way or another, therefore, everybody in this room, including me, has a special responsibility to do something. Either as an Arab, or a Muslim, or an American, or British, or any permutation of those four characteristics. And so, as I spoke to that rally on the 10th of January, I announced that we would lead a new organization was born that day. Viva Palestina would lead a convoy from England to Gaza, which we did on the 14th of February. 110 British vehicles, 300 British people, citizens, flying the British flag and the Palestinian flag, and carrying $2 million worth of aid all the way from London to Gaza. It was a long and difficult journey. We traveled 8,000 kilometers across 8 countries, across seas, and through many difficult days. We traveled through France, through Spain. We crossed by ferry to Morocco. We discovered that the border between Morocco and Algeria was locked. It had been locked for 16 years. Imagine, crystallizing the tragic division of the Arab world. Moroccans and Algerians look the same, sound the same, eat the same, say the same, read the same, they are the same people, and their borders, not only extant after all this time, but is actually locked shut. In fact, it's opened only twice in 16 years. Both times for me. In 1999, the day of in Baghdad, which is where I first had the honor of meeting Barbara, and in 2009 to allow our convoy through to Palestine. Well, they should make me the envoy between Morocco and Algeria. I could solve that problem. Whatever it is, no one actually knows why this border is locked. But they needed a blowtorch. They needed fire, flames, to open the border because it had rusted shut, not having been opened since 1999 when I last passed through it. And somehow that crystallized the great tragedy of the Arab world, divided, and by the way, at the same time, from the same building in which I work, by Mr. Sykes and Mr. Picot, the English and French colonial masters, who invented all these phony, fake Arab states in the first place, dividing the Arabs into many states, the better to rob them of their things. And we traveled across the whole of North Africa. The governments there, most of them, in all of them but one, it's a important to say this, not because I support the political system in Libya, I don't. But the Libyan government was the only government that really welcomed this convoy, and the only place where the people and the government did everything they could to make it a success. But we passed through all these North African countries. The government had to pretend to welcome us. The Prime Minister, I met some Tunisian friends earlier. The Prime Minister of Tunisia invited me to call upon him in Prime Minister's house, but only for the photo call. The meeting lasted exactly 5 minutes, and he did not say a single word. I had to fill the entire 5 minutes myself, just so it could appear on the television in Tunisia that the Prime Minister had received me. But behind the scenes, their government, like the others, hurried us through their territory as quickly as they could. They found desert roads that no one appeared to know about, that weren't even on maps, in order to keep us away from the populations of their countries. But I'll tell you something. All the soldiers and all the policemen in all of North Africa could not keep the population away from our convoy. They forced their way through the police, through the soldiers, to cut the convoy. Women were taking off their wedding rings and forcing them through the windows of our convoy, begging us to take them to Gaza. People were forcing biscuits, medicine, food, clothes on board our vehicles. They were begging us to take them to Gaza. One old man, an agricultural laborer, Tahir, in Algeria, he begged me to take him in the back of my own vehicle to Gaza. I told them, I sleep in the back of this vehicle. There's no room. And anyway, they're not shortened for Tahir in Gaza. What do you want to do there, I said. He said, I want them to know that when they bleed, when they cry, we cry, and that they're in our minds day and night in this terrible trial. A poor old man in Algeria, speaking for the whole Arab world. The elements, of course, are another thing. We arrived in Egypt, across the Libyan border, not with 110 vehicles, but now 220 vehicles, because Libya asked how many you have. I said 110. They said you now have 220. They doubled the size of the convoy. By the time you cross Egypt, this convoy was more than 2 miles long. Quite a demonstration of solidarity, which was its intention. People ask me, why did you go this long way? Why didn't you go through Europe, sail to Alexandria? I said, because I wanted to give the government of Egypt plenty of time to think about us. Plenty of time to decide how they were going to absorb this peaceful missile that was heading towards them, 2 miles long. And it was a good decision, because by the time we reached Egypt, such was the momentum behind this convoy, such was its importance, that we discovered we were now the official guests of the ruling party in Egypt, the National Democratic Party. We're a very popular party, by the way. They get roughly 99.9% of the vote in the election and held there. So we knew we were now the guests of some very important people. We were greeted with huge pictures of His Excellency President Hosni Mubarak. Indeed, every time I turned around, there was a picture of President Mubarak behind me. Well, that's good. I welcome that. Because we need to go back to Egypt again and again and again and again and again and again until we've knocked down this border between Egypt and that's the real problem, you see. I'm here to tell you that 61,000 houses knocked down in Palestine, never mind, they're ready to build them again. Thousands of people killed, maimed, amputated, orphans, never mind. More Palestinians were born during that 22 days than Israel managed to kill.
Alhamdulillah. The problem is not the Israeli assault. The problem is the siege. That's the real problem that's killing the Palestinian people. And let's analyze that siege. I told you earlier, I was all my life with Arafat, and I'm still with this. Life today. I'm not a supporter of Hamas. I've never been a supporter of Hamas. But I am a supporter of democracy. And the only people entitled to choose the government of Palestine are the Palestinian people here in Washington. Nobody in London, still left in Tel Aviv, is entitled to choose the leadership of the Palestinian people. But that's exactly why the siege was imposed. You know, we talk about democracy, exporting democracy, invading countries to impose democracy, Israel claiming to be a democracy. Well, the Palestinians already had a democracy. They had an election. It's the only free election ever held in any Arab country, ever in history. The trouble was, London and Washington and Tel Aviv didn't like the result. So they decided to starve people to death, to punish them, to hold the whole people hostage until they rolled over and cried, "Uncle." What kind of democracy is that? This murderous siege is what has to be ended. That's why I'm going to lead convoys to the Rafah crossing point from Britain, from the United States, later in the summer, from Venezuela, the Hugo Chavez, Viva Palestina, people from China. We're going to lead convoys every month to Rafah until we've opened this gate once and for all. So this brings me to the real point of my time now in the United States. I promised the people in Gaza, some of whom are eating from the garbage heaps. You have to know this. Every morning I watch women, always women, climbing on the garbage heaps looking for food. The 61,000 people whose homes were destroyed cannot rebuild them because not a brick, not a piece of wood, not a hammer, not a nail, not a sheet of glass is permitted under the siege to cross the border. They're still living outside. This siege is the one that has to be broken. And I promised the Palestinian people in Gaza that I would come to the United States of America and I would organize a convoy of hundreds of American vehicles flying American flags, and that they too would break the siege of Gaza. They too would drive through this checkpoint at Rafah. That's why I launched last month in California, Viva Palestina, US. And that's what we are going to do on the 4th of July. When else? American Independence Day. Ron Kovic, the Vietnam War veteran, on whose life born on the 4th of July was made. He's not Tom Cruise, he's a bigger star than Tom Cruise, I tell you. We are going to meet from the United States on the 4th of July, a convoy of those hundreds of vehicles that will break that siege. Now, how will it happen? You have an easier job than me. I have to drive all the way. You can't. Here's how it's going to work. Anyone who can raise the amount of money required to buy a vehicle in Egypt will fly with us in a charter plane, I hope 2 charter planes, or 3 charter planes, from Egypt there. We will leave JFK in New York on the 4th of July. We'll fly to Cairo. We'll buy vehicles in Egypt. We'll fill those vehicles with aid that we buy in Egypt. We'll put American flags on the front of the vehicles, and we'll drive to Russia. And I promise you, when President Obama sees hundreds of American flags heading for Russia, he's going to move out of the way and he's going to open that door. I promise you that. And we're not going to break any U.S. laws either. I know it's difficult here, more difficult than in England or elsewhere. The aid will be handed to non-government organizations, charities, churches, universities, hospitals, impeccable non-political recipients of a humanitarian aid convoy. You won't get into any trouble by joining us on that convoy. So I want to see at least one, and I hope several, vehicles bearing the name of Berkeley, California on that convoy on the 7th of July. You're going to be amongst those that little girl in Gaza was talking about, who turned away and left her alone. And I don't think that you want to be amongst that number. I believe that this is an important turning point. I believe it because I think Israel spent much of its remaining political capital in the world in the murderous bombardment of Gaza during those 22 days, which achieved nothing, didn't even get the criminals who did it re-elected. I believe that the United States now has a government which can see things more clearly. I know that Barack Hussein Obama has many pressures upon him. I know that if we leave him alone, he will not change. There are many other forces seeking to keep American policy as it is. But I believe that President Obama is the most clever president you've ever had. The last guy has the excuse that he was an idiot, an imbecile. President Obama does not have that excuse. President Obama has sat at the feet of Professor Edward Said. President Obama knows the truth. And he knows something else, that if American policy toward that region remains the same, then nothing will change in relation to America's problems in the world. Because Palestine is the heart of the matter. Palestine is the key to the crisis between the West and the East. It's the key to the crisis between the Muslim world and the non-Muslim world. And heaven knows, in your country and in mine, we ourselves have also now begun paying a price for that crisis. If he doesn't change American policy, there's no point in closing Guantanamo Bay, because he'll only have to reopen it again, and many other Guantanamo Bays. Because that swamp of hatred that's out there, in which many horrors are developing, will be filled, not drained, if U.S. policy remains the same towards this question. And all we're asking for is an American government to pursue a policy in the interests of the people of the United States of America towards the Middle East. That's all. We're asking for a policy in the interests of the people of the United States, rather than the exploiters and the arms manufacturers and the occupiers of Palestinian land. That's the change that we are asking. If we make that change, then the hatred of your country and mine, which has been growing, has been mutating in that swamp these last years, will begin to diminish. So, there can be no peace without justice. No justice, no peace. It's a very simple slogan. And the beginning of that justice is to lift the siege on Gaza, to recognize the political leaders of the Palestinian people, all of them, not the ones you like, not the ones you we prefer to talk to, but the ones who represent the people of Palestine. There can be no solution without a Jewish, or we know, as a former, longer, even bigger empire than yours. There is no future in trying to dictate to other people who speaks for them. We tried it in the north of Ireland for a long, long time. We got some help from you, from Senator George Mitchell, no less. And we now have a political process in the north of Ireland which has begun to bring an end to 400 years of war and occupation in Britain and in Ireland. You know, we used to refuse to allow the real leaders of the nationalist population in the north of Ireland even to appear on TV. An actor used to speak their words. We refused to recognize them. We called them terrorists. We said we'd never deal with them. And the last time I saw Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness, they were sitting in the Oval Office talking to President Barack Obama. It's doomed the policy. It's doomed the policy of refusing to recognize other people's leaders. So, I've come to the end of the time I have. I'm speaking in Irvine tomorrow, then Sacramento, then Anaheim. If you want more, catch up with me. Salaam alaikum.
That was Respect MP George Galloway speaking in Berkeley, California on May 20th. He goes on to Cleveland, Ohio tomorrow and will be in New York City on May 26th. This is Raising Sand Radio on KZSU Stanford, and I'm your host, Susan Gallimore. Staying on the topic of Gaza, I'd like to share an article by Ayman Mohelden, published in Al Jazeera, May 20th, 2009. Titled Hopes and Dreams on the Gaza Coast, it offers a fuller picture of Gaza and the possibilities were the political situation different. Every day as the sun sets on the coast of Gaza, people make their way to the coffee shop lined beaches and the potholed streets that run parallel to its coastline. On the terrace of the famed Al Dira Hotel, patrons jostle for position, sipping sweet Arabic coffee as the sounds of legendary Arab musicians delicately waft through the air, mingling with the aroma of flavored tobacco. They all share one aim: to gaze out into the Mediterranean Sea as its turquoise waters transform into blue, then purple, and then disappear into the moonlit night. Another day has passed in Gaza. For a few minutes, where the sun and water meet and the sky glows warm, people here are moved by a deep beauty, and for those few minutes, the beaming smiles of children frolicking in the sands, the laughter of friends, and the line of fishermen setting out into the horizon suspend Gaza's seemingly eternal suffering. It's that time of year again, when temperatures rise and where the coast of Gaza takes on a whole different meaning. In this tiny territory, caged in by Israel on two sides, north and east, and by Egypt to the south, Gaza's west coast becomes its gateway to the world of possibilities and a painful reminder of its limited realities. Gaza's shoreline is a deceptive one. Its long, white, sandy beaches are the ideal location for luxury hotels, trendy cafes, a vibrant nightlife, boutique shops, a palm tree-lined promenade for the health-conscious jogger, the inspired artist seeking to capture its beauty, or the local street vendor selling traditional Palestinian handcrafts. With its year-round perfect Mediterranean weather, rich history at the crossroads of continents and civilizations, and Arab hospitality, Gaza should be a tourist haven and entrepreneur's dream. Businesses, corporations, and financial towers should be vying for this prime real estate. Instead, today its 41-kilometer-long, poorly paved Corniche Road is marked with potholes. Sections of it have been destroyed by Israeli air raids over the years. A journey from its northern border to the south can take hours to travel as you zigzag through the destroyed stretches of road and the rubble of buildings leveled during Israel's recent war. All along the coastal stretch, crowded and dirty refugee camps edge closer to the water, squeezing every inhabitable inch available. The drive along the coast is marked by the smell of raw sewage spilling out into the sea at various points. The coast's most underdeveloped stretches are from scars from where Israel maintained its military outposts and illegal settlements that were a chokehold on the Gaza Strip. When the Israeli military and settlers pulled out in 2005, they left behind the land and the coast but left Gaza in ruins, caged in and cut off from the outside world. Since 2006, when Hamas won democratic elections that were recognized by international observers as free and fair, Israel has imposed an increasingly stifling siege on Gaza, restricting everything that comes in and out of the Strip. The vast majority of the 1.5 million Palestinians living here have not been allowed to leave this territory, which is approximately 360 square kilometers in size. Every facet of life in Gaza has been restricted beyond imagination by Israel, crippling the economy and increasing the psychological pressure on the territory's people. Nowhere else in Gaza is the economy more visibly in tatters than along its coast. Its hotels, once buzzing with vacationing Palestinians from the diaspora, and the sounds of wedding parties during the summer are a faint echo of their past. A pyramid-shaped building on Gaza's northern shore was supposed to be the Mövenpick Hotel, but it, like Gaza, never realized its full potential. Today it stands nearly complete but hollow, scarred by war, yet towering over the pristine sands of the sea. For centuries, generations of Gaza fishermen set sail from its port cities, earning a livelihood for their families, feeding hundreds of local restaurants, and giving the territory a distinct fish flavor to its food. In Rafah, fishermen annually prepared for the sardine harvest this time of the year. This would have been peak season for them. Today, these fishermen are not allowed to exceed 3 nautical miles off the coast, far short from what is legally permissible by international law. When they do try to fish beyond the imposed limits, they are harassed, shot at, and detained by the Israeli Navy, which patrols Gaza coast ferociously. Gaza City's fish market was known for its colorful array of seafood, from crabs to shrimp, sharks to local catches. The fish market at the port was so renowned that it was the preferred market for Israeli Jews, whose own coast dwarfs the length of Gaza's. Back then, as it is today, Gaza was under Israeli military control, but unlike now, Palestinians and Israelis were allowed to move freely between the two territories. Gaza's gateway to the world was through its port. The blueprints had already been drawn up. The Gaza City port was to be transformed into a modern-day commercial trading hub, bringing cargo vessels from Europe, Africa, and Asia across the Mediterranean Sea. But that too never materialized. Today, empty vessels and rusted and decrepit dinner boats encrust the port. Besides the economic potential, or lack thereof, the coast has also come to symbolize something immeasurable. At a time when the Palestinian people are under a siege that has prevented them from exercising their most basic rights and freedoms, the Gaza coast has become an important psychological tool. It has become a vehicle to escape their daily struggles. Anyone who approaches the coast and stares aimlessly out at the horizon is forced to dream. Dream about what? It's up to them, but they find themselves thinking about what lies beyond their immediate physical limitations. One simply cannot look at its beautiful waters and not imagine what lies beyond. Your brain begins to race with endless possibilities around the rest of the world. You immediately ask yourself, what if? What if Gaza were not under siege? What if I could take a ferry to Cyprus? What if Gaza was free to pursue its economic potential? A few minutes staring at the coast, and one suddenly realizes the people are thinking about everything and anything that has nothing to do with Gaza. When people are thinking about Gaza, it is not about Gaza as it is, but what it could or should be. As a good friend of mine who regularly frequents the Al Dira Hotel Terrace put it, typical of the melancholy and pride of living in Gaza, its sea not only inspires unending spirit and wonder, but it also, oftentimes, instills a sense of sorrow as one sees this great symbol of freedom one is unable to touch. But Gaza's sea will continue to inspire freedom no matter the circumstances. So it is that, as the sun sets on its shores and the light merges with nightfall, days become weeks and months become years, Gaza's besieged coast becomes an outlet to nothing but hope for its people. That was Ayman Mohelden in Al Jazeera on May 20th, 2009. And that's our show for today. As usual, views expressed are those of the hosts and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. Join us again next week when we'll bring you several views of a topic that is dividing a small island community in the San Francisco Bay Area. Alameda Unified School District's proposed anti-bullying curriculum, which includes teaching about different kinds of families and different kinds of people. It speaks of tolerance for diversity and how bullying is wrong, including labeling one another gay or lesbian, apparently quite popular among young school-aged children these days. This curriculum has launched a furor in the small community. Meanwhile, nearby San Leandro School District implemented this program several years ago, and the amount of bullying has decreased significantly, resulting in saved staff time and fewer suspensions. The curriculum is 2 30-minute lessons per year. Join us for that next week. We'll go out again with Lucy Murphy's music, Palestine.
In this modern time, you can't help but say the word Palestine. People there have lost their land. Some have lost their home. They live in other countries. Their freedom almost gone. Palestine needs her freedom. Palestine needs our love. Palestine needs her freedom. Palestine needs our love. There seems to be no answer to give us the reason why people cannot live. So no one has to die. We've got to take a stand for freedom. Take a stand for truth. Take a stand for justice. That's what we've got to do. 'Cause Palestine needs her freedom. Palestine needs our love. Palestine needs her freedom. Palestine needs our love. People there are rich. People there are poor. Some have education. So what are they fighting for? Fighting for their freedom. Fighting for their land, fighting for their children. Let's help them take a stand. Palestine needs her freedom. Palestine needs our love. Palestine needs her freedom. Palestine. We need a new beginning. Let us plant the seed. Plant the seed of love. Let that love seed grow. Plant the seed for everyone so all the world will know that Palestine needs her freedom. Palestine needs our love. Palestine needs her freedom. Palestine needs our love. Palestine needs her freedom.